Hi and welcome to the new season of The Hopeful Activist. We've had a bit of an upgrade, so I hope you like what you hear from us today. My name is Abby Thomas and I am your regular host. And in our new format, I'm going to be joined each month by a co-host to help me explore our chosen topic. And I'm delighted today to be joined by Isabel Pedro, who we will be meeting in just a moment. Here at The Hopeful Activists, we believe that Jesus is in the business of transformation and hope, and that we have a part to play in that. So we want to encourage and support activists. And we often get asked, how do we define activists? Well, we mean people who are bringing hope and transformation across society, in their local communities, and in the world of business and politics too. So in short, I'm sure it includes you. We run a course for Christian activists called Praxis Labs. And with exciting news for you today, Praxis Labs 2 is currently in development. And as we start our new season, I want to thank Mel, Adam, Kath and Cyrita for their feedback on the podcast, which has helped to shape the next season of The Hopeful Activists. And to Micah Purnell for our fab new artwork and Dr. J for the wonderful music. So today we're going to be exploring the topic of justice for refugees with my co-host Isabel. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi.
It's so good to be here with you today. Tell me a little bit about yourself and why you're here with me today.
My name is Isabel Pedro, and I'm 25 years old. I've been in UK for 8 years now, and also I'm a student, and I'm asylum seeker as well, and I am proud to be here to interview you.
And you've got a bit of experience in the media, and you'd like to go into the media, I think?
Yes, I'm interested to be a reporter for sport. So 2018, I did my first work experience at the BBC. That was an amazing experience I ever had in my life. And I'm looking forward to see where I'm going to go from.
Excellent. TV or radio, were you at the BBC?
TV.
Yeah, sounds fun. We've got loads coming up on the programme today, Isabel. We're going to be hearing from a couple who just recently escaped from Afghanistan. And we're going to be hearing from a storyteller. And I think you're going to be interviewing Dave Smith.
David Smith. And I hope things are going to go well. I have a lot of questions to ask him today.
Yeah, and he's going to be talking about his work.
Yeah, as a Boaz Strauss as well. So I'm more interested about Boaz Strauss. I want to know more about how he manages, how he works with the refugee and asylum seekers as well.
So a few headlines before we go on. The Young Christian Climate Network pilgrimage to COP26 is now in Scotland, and the pilgrims have had excellent engagement from churches and MPs as they've travelled from Cornwall. We also have an update from TIFF and as they work towards the conference.
Hi, I'm Billy from Tearfund's advocacy team. Here at Tearfund, we're working at full steam getting ready for COP26. We'll be both praying and lobbying for change, and we would love you to join us. Our team in the Blue Zone, that's the UN space which hosts the negotiations, they especially need our prayers, so please sign up to our prayer text service. And also do get involved with the Day of Action on the 6th of November in Glasgow. Or at other locations across the UK. You can find out lots more on our dedicated COP26 page. Abby's going to put the links all into the show notes. And so we look forward to seeing you, some of you hopefully, around the country on the Day of Action and praying together at this crucial time. Thanks so much.
We're looking at activism with and for refugees today, and there was a prayer vigil in Manchester outside the Conservative Party conference earlier this month, standing against aspects of the new Nationalities and Borders Bill. The vigil supported the work of the grassroots coalition group Together with Refugees, which calls for a kinder, fairer and more effective approach to supporting refugees in the UK. And the president of the Methodist Conference, Reverend Sonia Hicks, spoke at the vigil.
While a fair asylum system is essential, some of these proposals appear to stand in direct contradiction of our biblical imperative to welcome the stranger. As church, we must be seeking to offer sanctuary, to witness to God's love, and to stand up for justice. We must speak up for human dignity and flourishing. Oppose the Borders Bill. Oppose a two-tiered asylum system. Demand a just and fair system for all.
And on Wednesday, Women for Refugee Women are holding a refugees welcome rally outside Parliament. This hasn't actually happened as we are recording now on Tuesday, but I hope that by the power of technology, You will hear some audio from that protest now.
Before we go any further, let's see more facts and information about refugee and asylum seekers in the UK.
Hi, I'm Neelam Benares from the Snowdrop Project, and here are some facts about refugees and asylum seekers. An asylum seeker is someone whose request for sanctuary and protection has not yet been processed. A refugee is someone whose application for asylum has been successful, and so the UK authorities have accepted that this person is at risk of persecution, and in doing so, have agreed not to return them to their country of origin. Under the 1951 Convention, a person is entitled to make a claim for asylum if they have a well-founded fear of persecution, which is serious harm, for one of the five convention reasons, either because of their race, their religion, their nationality, their political opinion, or because they're a member of a particular social group. In addition, applicants have to prove that the state authorities cannot protect them and they cannot internally relocate in their country to avoid the harm. UK government is obliged to consider asylum applications fairly and accurately, provide access to subsistence and accommodation if required, provide free health care from the National Health Service, and provide legal help if the applicants cannot afford to pay for legal help. People often ask, why don't people claim asylum in the first safe country that they find? Experts have almost unanimously stressed the fact that asylum seekers often pick the UK because of cultural, family and language ties. Those travelling to the UK might already have relatives living here, or they speak English instead of other European languages. Also, sometimes an asylum seeker is under the control of a smuggler, and so they may not have a choice of where they end up. The media makes it seem as though UK has been inundated with migrants. The data shows this isn't the case. According to the UNHCR, in 2020, the highest number of asylum applicants received in the European Union were received by Germany. They received 122,000 applicants, followed by France, which received 93,000 applicants. In this same period, the UK only received 36,000 applicants. The UK received only 7% of the total asylum applications in the European Union and the UK. There are several resettlement schemes in action in the UK at the moment. Most recently, the UK introduced the Afghan Citizen Resettlement Scheme. Resettlement schemes are separate from the standard procedure for claiming asylum in the UK. Applications are often made via the UNHCR offices in other countries, which then are referred to the UK Home Office. In 2020, there were only 77 refugees, including dependents, resettled via the Gateway programme in the UK. This was a large decrease compared with earlier years. It probably reflects the impact of COVID-19. And that's all from me today. Thank you for listening. This is Neelam Benares from the Snowdrop Project.
And I was looking at the results of a recent Ipsos poll today, Isabel, that show that on balance, Britons are more positive than negative about the impact of immigration on this country, with 45% seeing it as positive and 31% seeing it as negative, with a quarter sort of not decided yet what they think. Mm-hmm. And the survey also showed that the majority of people, that's 56%, say they have sympathy with the migrants attempting to cross the English Channel, while 39% say they don't have sympathy, which in itself is a tragic figure. But it is positive that at least more than half of people do have sympathy. Of course, many people are refugees because they're first activists, and their activism makes their life in their country dangerous or even life-threatening. And I went to meet Benafsha and Mehdi, who came to the UK on one of the final flights from Kabul Airport after Kabul fell to the Taliban in August. Benafsha's work made her well known, and they feared for her life. And Benafsha and Mehdi both have almost total vision loss from their birth, and they have worked for the rights of people with disabilities in Afghanistan with their organisation Rahyab. Benafsha began by telling me a little bit about herself and the work that she's been involved with.
I'm Benafsha Yaqoubi, Afghanistan Human Rights Commissioner. And we are here because of the bad situation and crisis in our country, as you know. When our last government was collapsed, the Taliban came to our city. There was no space for our work. We had some documents from UK government and we had some documents from Danish government. So the big problem was for us was that we couldn't go inside the airport because, you know, on that day there was many rush because of evacuation program and shooting, firing and this difficulty. So it was really impossible for us to go inside the airport. And through the help and assist of the Danish government, we tried to go inside the airport and we choose between two countries that we have some authority documents for travel from them. One was UK and the other was Denmark. We choose to come to UK and thanks from UK government that we are here now and we are safe.
And tell me a little bit about your work, Banafsha. You worked for the Afghan Independent Human Rights Commissioner.
Yeah, for in the past 2 years, I worked for Afghanistan Human Rights Commission, and I was a commissioner there. And I worked in two areas. One was protection and promotion of the rights of persons with disability, and the other was investigation of violation, human rights violation, and especially our work was about the person who were inside the detainee.
Person deprived from liberty.
Yeah, the person deprived from the liberty, yeah. And it was, so the problem was that because some of these persons knew me very well, so it was difficult for us to stay there and because these two areas was very vital for our commission and was very important.
Mehdi, tell me a bit about yourself.
Yeah, my name is Mehdi Salami. Before coming out of Afghanistan, I was the director of an NGO called the Organization of Rahyab for Rehabilitation Services for the Blind, ORRSB. And the word Rahyab is a Persian word that means pathfinder. And through that organization, we would work for the rights of people with disabilities in general and those with vision impairments and multiple and additional impairments, in particular in case of rehabilitation and assistive education, etc. When the Taliban took over, we thought that there was no room for us to be ethical activists. In the previous system, we would have good freedom in our work to be with boys and girls and ladies and gentlemen. The new ruling system are making restrictions specifically for female people. So we tried a lot to find a way to go out outside the country. Even we tried a lot, there's two times to go to the airport, but there was a very bad rush and firing and shooting that made us to come back. So thanks to the Danish government for the extraction special op that made it possible for us to somehow enter the airport.
And you both are partially sighted? Or?
Yeah, we were born with total vision impairment, total blindness, if you say.
Mm. And how did that affect your leaving of Afghanistan? I imagine that made it a little more
difficult.
Yeah,
actually, that time, even almost every person would be vulnerable because they were shooting, firing, and even splashing a variety of gas sprays. So for us, this vulnerability would be doubled or even multiplied.
And Afghanistan has faded from the news headlines in the past few weeks. I mean, you've been here less than two months, but already it's left the headlines. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about the situation there, particularly for people who have a disability. Why don't you tell me a bit about that, Banafsha?
Sometimes I'm thinking with myself and I'm talking with Mehdi, When we were in Afghanistan, we had our normal life, though we were with disability, although there was there were many problems and challenges for all persons with disability and with vulnerability, we can say. We always try to tell all people, if you have a big will, if you try hard, if you work hard, you will be successful. So we try to show these things in our life. And honestly, in that time, I didn't thought about the challenges that we had, because we had already our organization to support persons with disability, as Mehdi said. And we tried to be their voice, we tried to advocate for them, we tried to think in this way, though disability cannot stop us, although there was some difficulty. So nowadays, it is honestly very difficult for, even for us. I am here, I'm in UK, development country, everything is good, but I think I'm lost. I lose my way, I lose my hopes, I lose my dreams, I lose my people, and I lose my job, I lose my life, everything. But the problem for persons with disability and with vulnerability who are there, who are in Afghanistan, this is much more worse than me, as I think, because nowadays they don't have any place to go for their rights. Who can advocate for their rights? Who will fight for their rights, and who will help them to go to the school? If we think about the children with disability, if we have a problem in a country, so the people who are more than vulnerable, these are people with vulnerability, and especially people with disability.
And what is, Mehdi, if I can ask you, what is the view of the Taliban of people with disabilities? What is their theological sort of understanding?
Actually, that would lead us to a very, very, deep understanding of their religion towards the people with disability. Actually, even when we go it through a historical point of view, the religion that the Taliban are following came in a period in which all people around the world would think about people with disability as people, at least in its best perspective, persons worthy of only mercy and compassion, you know, not dignity, not actually thing like equal to other people. Yeah. So we see in the news that when they established their new government, there was no room for persons with disability among the if you say ministers. So, but now, after over 2 weeks of establishing the new government, now they appointed somebody as the minister for martyrs and disabled, what they say. Only I can say we must monitor their deeds towards people with disabilities, what they are going to do from now onwards.
And you used to, when you were in Afghanistan, you worked for the rights of people with disabilities, Mehdi. Tell me a bit about that work and how you'd like to see it continue now you're here.
Yeah, very good question. So actually the ORRSB would work jointly with a network of entities, more than 15 or 20 counterpart organizations, in case of advocacy for the rights of people with disability, for example, visiting officials, lobbying with the local authorities, or even nationwide authorities.
And how would you like to see that work continue now? You are refugees and you're here in the UK. Do you see a way forward?
The ORRSB should continue its work. We are deeply thinking and working on the technical and practical ways of that. We will make a kind of local directorate, local country directorate of that organization under the leadership we establish here. We will do our best to make it go on. One of the things that we would do before even was kind of employment training or vocational training or like computer trainings and some other handcrafts skills training.
And I think when we spoke earlier, Benafsha, you were talking about the using technology to help.
So we are trying to have our program online, and we are trying to have our program kind of homeschool. Some trainers, some people who are there, they can go and visit the family and the children, and they are trying. We are trying to have educational and rehabilitative program for them there as well.
What do you think the UK government and people in the UK should do to support people in Afghanistan now?
I have a request from UK government, EU and US, all
superpowers.
They can have authority, they can help people in that country. It can be two-sided. We must have some issuing some visa for some people who cannot stay there, like women who are leader. So we must have this kind of visa, this kind of programs for these people for now. And then we must work with that people, with Taliban, with the next government. They must consider human rights, they must consider women rights, and they must be inclusive. Because if we say we must try to get out 30 or 35 million people from Afghanistan, it's not achievable, I think. So we must work and try to fix that country issue and problems, so at least they can live there and we can serve that people and that country. This is the thing that make me alive, as I will try to get hope to those hearts who were really very close to me. And now they forced me from them, but they cannot take away them from my heart.
These people that you used to work with, you mean?
Yeah, these people, these vulnerable people who are living there, the people who came and the situation forced me from them. Now I'm very far from them, but honestly, they cannot take them away from my heart. Mm-hmm. They are in my heart, and the thing that make me alive and make me continue, it's my hope, is that I can work for them and I can take hope to their life.
Mm. Yeah. So good to hear the story that as a asylum seeker I am, I can see what the feeling, and I'm happy for them when they get the stage, so that's great.
Yeah, they are a completely amazing and inspiring couple. It was a real privilege to
talk to them and to know more about them. That's what was amazing.
Mm. We also want to include in each of our episodes someone who's responding creatively to the issue that we're talking about and who will hopefully inspire us as well to use our creative side in our activism. So I had the opportunity to go and speak to Faraha Musanzi at the Millside Centre in Bradford. And I just need to say before we listen to this that her story does contain some distressing details. She began by telling me a little bit about herself.
Yeah, so my name is Faraha. I am originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo. I moved to the UK at the age of 11, back in 2002 with my family. Initially came here under my dad's student visa, and then his visa expired and we couldn't go back home because of the work that we're doing, working as peacemakers in Congo. So we ended up going through the asylum process and then eventually became refugees. I've been living here for a very long time and I feel quite British in many ways, but also very much not.
And how do you see refugees and migrants and asylum seekers, as you've had that experience too, in the media, and how did that affect you growing up here as a young person?
Yeah, well, I think just the first thing is I noticed, I mean, even back then, there was a lot of negative things being told about migrants in general. Everybody were put in one boat, you know, that were coming here to steal people's jobs and costing the government too much money, taking housing and so on. And so even at the young age of like 11, 12, I remember being really affected by that actually. And it just made me feel very unwanted. It made me feel very out of place. And it took me a very long time to accept that this was our new home. Yeah, and we did have a really amazing community of people who did do that for us, which was a blessing. But at the same time, I knew that the general perspective you know, stereotype of refugees and asylum seekers was not, it was completely the opposite. So I made sure I tried, it's very funny, even the way I spoke, I didn't want to sound like I was from a particular place, even though I learned English in Bradford, which always confuses people. You just start becoming very aware of how people perceive you.
You've described some of your experiences in your storytelling. Tell me a bit about where you share your stories, and then if you could share a part of one of your stories with us, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. So I normally attend a storytelling called 10 by 9, which is a storytelling group that meets once a month here at the Millside Centre, bringing together local people who share real stories from their lives on based on a theme. And yeah, so I've written many, many stories. A lot of them tend to go back to my childhood for some reason. And yeah, so I'd love to share one with you. So this story is called Scars. We all carry scars, hidden or invisible, that tell stories of lived experiences, words spoken to us that cuts deep, and silence that rings louder than action. Sometimes we carry faint scars that transcend generations, and a simple scratch on our skin can expose wounds not yet healed, and in an instant we begin to bleed afresh. The first scar on my skin was an accident. At only 9 months old, I was crawling around the kitchen while my mother cooked food for our family. I have no recollection of how things unfolded, but I am told that my mother turned her eyes away from me only for a second, and the next thing she remembers is the pot of hot boiling water tumbling on my right hand, as if it was in slow motion. Then there was silence, but for only a second, which was followed by a loud, excruciating but powerful scream straight from my young, fragile lungs, pleading for help. The pain was too much for me to bear. As she rushed towards me helplessly and picked me up, she noticed that the burn on my hand was forming under my jumper, and she knew this would not end well. She wept silently as she rushed me to hospital, her heart racing and nearly pumping out of her chest, praying that I would get seen and treated quickly. I still bear that scar this day. It's funny, isn't it, how an instant moment of pain or trauma can have such a lasting impact in our life and transform us. The second scar, also in my right hand, was equally an accident. I was 9 years old, living under lockdown, stuck in my parents' office in a living room filled with 30 plus people, fearful for their lives. We were in hiding from the outside world, and the virus was tribal conflict, which sadly involved my tribe and the neighboring tribe to take up arms, machetes, or whatever weapon they could find to kill. No mercy, no remorse. I was too young to understand the complexity of the war or what caused the disease in one's heart to turn into violence, but yet old enough to comprehend that taking another's life was simply not going to solve anything. It had been days since I stepped outside to feel the tropical Congo warm sun burn on my skin, weeks since I saw my extended family, and months since the schools had closed. I imagine the sky turning red and the air smelling like death, a symbol of the harsh reality we were forced to live in. In these circumstances, sleeping peacefully was a privilege, and there was a haunting, tense fear that overcame my entire body, and it would send shivers down my spine and make me shake uncontrollably. It's crazy how our bodies can react to fear and respond in mysterious ways. We spend our days and nights in the same room, seeing the same faces, sharing whatever meal our mothers could put together, and sleeping on the floor or wherever we felt comfortable. One evening, I became restless. My entire body ached. I closed my eyes to try and find my happy place, but all I could see was dead bodies, so I quickly opened my eyes again. The mat I slept on was thin and made from dried palm leaves, and as I got up to adjust my pillow, I felt a deep cut right below my elbow, and blood began to trickle down, which left a scar that I still carry today. I arrived in the UK carrying these scars and layers of many unseen. I went to school not knowing a word of English and had to adjust to new life. But I knew my struggle would be different. I noticed that I was different, so I intentionally carried myself differently. I didn't have much compared to the other kids around me. They would often ask me lots of questions about where I came from and why I was here, and I lacked the words or vocabulary to simplify my answer or tell a story about my life experiences that would appease their curiosity. I knew they wouldn't understand, and when I did speak, some would mock my French accent. So when I started secondary school, I made a vow to never speak in class. So I did just that. I wanted to blend in and almost be invisible, and I never said a word in class for 3 years. My tutor group with familiar faces and names was my only safe space to interact with people I somewhat knew. But once the bell rang, I assumed my silence, tried not to make eye contact with anyone, and quickly made my way to class. During break times, I'd spend my time in the library burying my face in books and trying to learn about English literature, history, and my art class became my sanctuary. I longed to pick up books and read about stories of people who looked and sounded like me, and the only thing I learned about Black history in school was slavery, and enduring that awkward class for 2 hours felt like an eternity. It saddened me that all people knew of my ancestors was that we were slaves and needed colonizing. I wished I could tell them stories of movers and shakers from my country who fought the system and sacrificed their lives to obtain independence and find freedom. From Patrice Lumumba to my grandfather, who became the first regional MP and served his family and community with pride, encouraging all his children to access the very thing he was denied, education.
What an incredible, incredible piece of writing. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a very, I find it really therapeutic to think back of where I come from and to form words that try to piece those things together. Mm. Yeah.
And you have a YouTube channel where you have some singing as well. I saw a really moving interview with your parents where you talked about some of the experiences you'd had in this country of racism, and spoke really beautifully about how to, how you've coped with that and how to move on. Your mum spoke about how it's really important, especially for women and refugee women, to speak out and use your voice. What advice would you give to people about doing that? Because I know there must be sensitivities and risks of sharing those difficult and traumatic experiences.
Yeah, I think it takes time to heal from so many traumas that people have faced before they even arrive in this country. And I think many of us have never had access to therapy or counselling. And, you know, I see a lot of people that I know turn to their faith for healing, for comfort and resilience. I guess the advice is just to find a safe space, a community where they can freely bring their frustrations, because I think there is a need for that, where people can just open up and share, you know, what they're finding difficult. And there's not a lot of places that that exist like that. So I think even if it's just a person that can listen to them and, you know, try and give them encouragement and just show them that there is hope and things will get better. I think, you know, that just having one person that can shine a light in the dark situation can make a huge difference. And I think also it's just for people to realize that their voice does matter. I know my parents, you know, they run a charity even here that tries to bring new arrivals together to talk about their issues, but also look at how they can move forward, because I think it's so easy for us to be stuck in that place of constantly having so many needs and not knowing how we can progress. But education is a key part of that. You know, we really encourage people to make sure you learn English, make sure you can communicate, because without the language, you're just going to be stuck in a cycle and not know where to turn. And being able to speak the language, you know, makes people confident enough to, you know, to know that when they do face, for example, hate crimes, or you know that something happens to their kids at school, they can report it. You know, they're not just forced to remain silent and pretend it's not happening. So I think once people are confident enough to speak the language, to know their rights, to know that, you know, that there are services out there they can access, it makes them feel a lot more supported, and you know, they can share the burdens and the difficulties they're going with people who care and can bring them up from that place.
And going back to the singing as well, part of your creativity, you sing with your parents, mm-hmm. and your sister as well, I think.
Since a young age, actually, we've always had a family choir. Worship, especially music, Christian music and gospel music, has been something that has kept us sane. Like I said, growing up in a war-torn country where everything around you is so bleak, and you know, you're constantly hearing news of people you know being killed, and it's very traumatic. And being able to sing just uplifts you. It makes you feel blessed to be alive, to still have breath in your lungs to even utter those words and to say it. So yeah, it saved us from a lot of hardship, I have to say. And even to this day, we try and sing together every day if we can. But it is actually a huge part of our spiritual healing as well, not just singing for the sake of it, and really like actually understanding the words that we're saying, and living it out.
Yeah. Amazing. And you work here at the Millside Centre. You've already talked a little bit about the storytelling group. What other opportunities are there for refugees to come and be a part of what you do here?
Yeah, there's a lot. We're really blessed to be able to run quite a number of different services, you know, including a welcome cafe, which is run by refugees and asylum seekers. We train them in catering to learn basic cooking skills, to bring recipes from their countries, and to share that with the public. We also have knitting group. We have a youth group for young people. Quite a lot of people are from young people who come up from migrant backgrounds, and they're able to connect with each other, talk about, you know, their passions, their dreams, and just have banter and fun together. You know, so oftentimes people come with their primary needs of wanting to learn English, but actually what they really need is connection. They really need that sense of community. So everything we do is quite intentional. It's not just about teaching an English class, it's looking at how can we help people holistically so that when they leave this place, they feel lighter than they came.
Thank you so much, Faraha, for sharing your story with us. You can find out more about the 10x9 storytelling group that she mentioned through the show notes attached to this episode. And the link to Faraha's YouTube channel is there too, if you want to go and hear some of her family's music, which I really recommend. Isabel, I'm really looking forward to hearing your conversation with Dave now. I'll hand over to you to interview him.
Thank you, Abby. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
So I'm going to start. I have a lot of questions for you, mm-hmm. but I'm going to start with the most. I want to know that, first of all. So how did you get started with your work with the refugee? And how long have you been doing it?
I've been doing it since December 1999. And I was working for the Mustard Tree, which is a homeless charity. I was running that. There was one day, beginning of December, and somebody rang the bell, and I went to the door, and there was this little man there, and he came from Iraq. And he had come because he'd heard that we give away secondhand clothing and bedding and things like that, and he'd come for some. And he came about three times a week after that, and each time he told me a little bit about his story. And I went to his flat, where they'd given him a flat on the 14th floor of a block of flats in Manchester. And the only thing that he had was a bed and a cooker. Wow. Nothing else. That's all he had. And that's why he was coming to us. And he was at that time, he was given vouchers. He didn't get any cash at all. He just got vouchers. And there were only three places in Manchester where he could exchange them.
Yes.
And the nearest one was 2 miles away from where he lived. And wow. He couldn't catch a bus because he had no money. So he had to walk to this shop, and they didn't sell everything that he needed, which is why he kept coming to us. And then I heard his story, and I thought, how on earth can this be happening? And he told some other people, from some Afghans,
yes.
And then we got lots of Afghans coming in, and then the Afghans told some other people, and within a very short space of time, about 60% of the people coming in were asylum seekers and refugees. And I heard their stories, and I thought, how on earth can they be treated like this? And so that's how I got into...
And since then you started to work with the refugees?
We did more and more with them, and then discovered that some of them had been refused asylum.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were destitute. They didn't have anywhere to live. A friend of mine had a spare room, and the first person that stayed with him was from Zimbabwe.
Yes.
And we had a spare room as well, or a sofa bed, and a few people stayed on our sofa bed. And other people started to get involved in that way, and we set up a project with the Red Cross to provide food parcels as well.
That's great. So happy to hear that you could be helping refugee people and asylum seekers as well. So tell me a little bit more about Jubilee Plus Refugee Network and the work of Boaz Trust.
Yeah, well, it was 2003, I think, that we set up that project within the Mustard Tree, and it had really got too big for the actual organisation, and so I left in 2004 to set up the Boaz Trust, specifically to help with accommodation for people who were destitute, who'd been refused asylum. And so the Boaz Trust has grown a lot since then. I left a couple of years ago and worked for a national organisation called NACOM, which is basically a network of accommodation providers for people who are destitute.
So it's similar as a Boaz?
Yeah, that's right. There's all sorts of different projects right across the country doing similar sort of stuff. And also got involved with Jubilee Plus. Jubilee Plus is a social justice network. It's a Christian social justice network, and I run the refugee network part of that.
I'm just wondering if you could explain, I don't know whether you want to explain this, Isabel or Dave, why do people become destitute in the asylum system? Why is it that people aren't given housing or end up with anything to live on?
I think David is the good one to answer your question.
Well, I guess it's because they've been refused asylum generally. Although, even if you get your refugee status, you know, you've only got 4 weeks to move out of your accommodation. And often people don't get their universal credit in time. They haven't had any chance to save any money. They're told to go private. There is no private accommodation. And they can end up on the streets as well. So, but mostly it's because people's asylum claims have been refused. And at that point, they've got no recourse to public funds. So they can't get benefits, they have no accommodation, they have 3 weeks to get out of their accommodation, and they end up usually sofa surfing, maybe staying with friends if they can. Sometimes they'll try and stay on in the accommodation where they were, but they will have to give their keys back, so they rely on people letting them back in, and then they're staying on the sofa. And if it's during the week, sometimes there are checks on the accommodation by the accommodation provider, and if somebody is found there, then the person that's actually putting them up may be thrown out as well. So it's really, really difficult situation, and often that leads to people doing things that are not legal because there's no other way of surviving. Some people will be working illegally for very, very little money, if anything at all. Sometimes it will be looking after somebody's
child,
you know, some childcare in return for a bed. And sometimes that can be, there can be sort of bed for sex as well, which does happen, unfortunately. So people in really difficult situations, and the truth is that most people don't get sent back to their country of origin for all sorts of reasons.
And I remember before last year, 2019, the Home Office, they tried to provide sending me back to Angola. They find they sending me a letter, a lot of my information. They speak with the embassy in London from Angola. They were like, yeah, you have to leave the country immediately. You have to leave. And I know I'm not the first one to hear that. A lot of people as well, they hear that. And they, of course, they talk to you. They come to you. They say to you, like, what happened? So what kind of advice you give them?
It's really difficult. I mean, people need... If people are afraid of going back, they need to have a good solicitor. That's really difficult to get a solicitor.
Yes.
Very often, sometimes the country won't even accept somebody back. You know, that often happens. I've been to an embassy. I've been to the Ethiopian embassy, and they said, no, this person isn't from Ethiopia. We don't believe them. So they couldn't get the papers. So there are all sorts of reasons why people don't actually get sent back to their country of origin. But the best advice is to try and get some more evidence if you can, you know, if you're in that sort of situation. It's difficult to do because it has to be different. And actually getting the evidence, it is really tricky, particularly if you are somebody that's been persecuted, then... you know, lots of governments, they will mistreat people, but they don't give you an arrest warrant. They just beat you up, you know, or put you in jail. But how do you prove that you've been there? You know, it's really difficult.
And the Home Office, they don't even care about that. They keep saying, no, they don't believe it.
Yeah.
Most of the time they say, like, no, don't believe it. You should go back.
So when you had your interview, you had your asylum interview, What did they say to you? Did they actually believe you then at all? Or?
They do believe because then I was 17 years old when I came.
Yeah.
With my younger brother, I was 15, both of us. So they believe us.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was totally fine. Since my brother being 18, things changed. They were you guys have to leave the country.
It's like you suddenly become an adult at 18. If you're under 18, then you're provided for. You'll get accommodation. You will be looked after. You'll be in school. You maybe get a laptop and things like that. You know, you get things given you.
Yeah.
Social services look after you. Have some pocket money.
That's what they did.
But as soon as you're 18, if they don't believe you, then nothing. You've got nothing. And that's what happened to you.
That's what happened to me. Yes.
Yeah. So what's your situation now?
To be honest with you, I'm trying to find a new evidence to put in.
Yeah.
To put it in, so boys that they are helping me about that, and the other charities as well, they're helping me to find about that. So the advice that they gave me, they say, like, just don't give up, keep forward, keep your studying, and keep do like work experience in charities, things like that.
Yeah.
And I'm helpfully. That's a keeping all the time prayers God for that.
Yeah.
I don't want to go back.
Well, we know what to pray for.
I don't want to go back.
No, it's really difficult, and so many people have got a life here now. You know,
for a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, they've got friends. They don't have anything back home.
Yes. Yeah, but the Home Office, they don't even see that on us. Yeah. They don't even see. I meet people, they are here in the country for 20 years, 19 years, they don't have a stay.
Yeah.
And that was painful to me to see that they've been here for so long.
Yeah, I've got a friend from Sudan, and he's been here about 15 years or so. He's married, he's got two children. His wife's got refugee status, but he hasn't. They still refused. They won't believe him. Crazy, huh?
It's so crazy.
Yeah.
But I believe everything's going to be fine. As a Christian you are, do you think your faith is connected with this?
Yeah, definitely. you just have to go back to the things that Jesus said. He said that we should treat people the way we would like to be treated. Do to others what you would have them do to you. That's what he said, you know. I've heard so many stories and about what people have been through, and I think, how would I like to be treated if I was in that situation? We have to put ourselves in other people's shoes. And, you know, I've spoken to so many refugees and asylum seekers who have said that nobody listened to me. Nobody believed my story. That's the worst thing that can happen to anybody, I think. Not everybody that claims asylum is really genuine. There are some that are not, you know.
That's true.
But the vast majority are. Most people don't leave their country for no reason.
For no reason, yeah.
Yeah. No, most people don't go right the way across Europe for no reason, you know.
And how do you feel like working with different religions, people from different religions?
Yeah, I mean, within Boaz, I mean, it doesn't matter what religion anybody is. Yes. And I would say exactly the same. If, you know, as Christians, if we treat people well, they start to ask, why are you doing this? You know, lots of people within Boaz I know have become Christians, not because they've been preached to, but because they've been loved and looked after. Whether they do or not, it doesn't make any difference because they're human beings.
Yes.
And we need to treat everybody equally.
What are your hopes for the future?
Oh, well, at the moment, I'm doing quite a lot around the new immigration bill that's coming out in Parliament. I'm going to be writing letters to all of the MPs who call themselves Christians, but basically saying what I've just said to you, that, you know, if you're a Christian, this is how we should treat people.
Yeah.
Please vote against this bill, because Jesus wouldn't be happy with it.
It is, that's true.
Totally.
We've got a little clip of you, Dave, at the you were part of this vigil at the Conservative Party conference. Should we play to everyone what you said there?
Yeah, sure, sure.
Really?
Yeah, I'll play it for you.
Under the proposals of the Nationality and Borders Bill, anyone who crosses the Channel in a small boat or in the back of a lorry to claim asylum in the UK, according to Priti Patel and Victoria Atkins, even if they've worked for the British and escaped the Taliban in Afghanistan, will be subject to punitive new regulations. Their asylum claim may be dismissed immediately as inadmissible. They will be put in reception centres, which the government is planning to build for at least 8,000 new arrivals. They could be liable to up to 4 years in prison simply for not coming through a resettlement scheme, even though those resettlement schemes do not exist for 99% of those fleeing their country. And even people like the RNLI, who rescue them from the Channel, could face a jail term for facilitating illegal entry. All of that is in the Nationality and Borders Bill. There is much, much more in the 67 pages of the bill that will make anyone who believes in the Golden Rule shudder with embarrassment and disgust. If passed, it will prove once and for all that this country is not a Christian country.
So I asked the government to respond to what you'd said, Dave, and they said, "Our new plan is based on fairness. We stand by our moral and legal obligations to help innocent civilians fleeing cruelty from around the world. The UK resettlement scheme will continue to prioritise refugees, including children, in regions of conflict and instability, rather than those who are already in safe European countries. And they offer legal protection to the most vulnerable through government-backed legal routes, which, since 2015, over 25,000 vulnerable people, including children, seeking refuge from cruel circumstances across the world, have been settled in the UK more than any European country."
That's true, but it's totally disingenuous, because, you know, we 5,000 a year resettled out of millions who need somewhere safe. And we've heard the actual asylum statistics earlier in the programme, that Germany takes three times as many as us, France nearly three times as many as us asylum applicants. We're 17th in Europe in terms of the number of asylum applications per head of population. And it's all very well to say that people can stay in the first safe country, but that's because we're an island right at the end of the chain. And it's really difficult to get here. So if everybody stayed in the first safe country, then Greece would be absolutely full, and so would Italy and Spain, and we would get none. So, you know, that sort of response is absolute nonsense, to be quite honest.
I'm sure the government would just disagree, but we'll give you your expertise.
Yeah, then I heard that David was talking. The audio looked like you are very angry. Hungry, they say hungry, yeah? Anger, like the way you spoke.
I do get angry.
I
think God gets angry. I think God gets really angry at this. So.
He does. Yeah. He does get angry as well. Okay, David, and all of that conclusion, on your conclusion, what do you want to see in
what
the
do
future?
I want to see?
Yes.
I want to see a fair system. I want to see people welcomed to the UK, because when you know, that's actually the answer. If people are treated well, they respond well. If people are treated badly, that's when things go wrong. That's when things happen. You know, there is an upsurge of welcoming. So many people have said that they will open up their homes to Afghans that have come in. And I believe that if people knew the truth, if they heard the stories, like your story, like other people's stories, then they would be willing to welcome so many more people to this country. And I believe that's possible, because God is good.
All the time.
All the time.
Thank you so much, Isabel. Thank you, Dave. You can find out more about the work of Jubilee Plus and the Boaz Trust via the links in the show notes, of course. And we're going to finish each show with a Get Involved section. And Dave, you just mentioned then a few of the ways that people can get involved. And we're going to hear now from Sue Butler from Welcome Churches about how you can get involved with your church. And from Ahmad Al-Rashid from UK Welcomes Refugees.
Hi, Isabel. Hi, Abby. Thank you very much for having me. My name is Ahmad Al-Rashid, and I am here to talk to you about some ideas on how you can get involved with community sponsorship through the work that we are doing at UK Welcomes Refugees. UK Welcomes Refugees is part of a larger movement, a movement that seeks to build strong participation across the community sponsorship movement in the UK. So basically, a few years ago, the United Kingdom announced that they're going to resettle Syrian refugees. And there was a pledge within that communities would be able to help and support newcomers rebuild their lives in the UK. And I believe it was around 2016 or early 2017 when we started to have communities across the United Kingdom coming together, working together to help share the responsibility of welcoming newcomers. And the aim is to recruit more community sponsors, to raise awareness, to get people to know about the challenges that refugees are facing, why people are fleeing conflicts, why people are fleeing persecution, and how they, as community sponsors, as individuals, entities, or organizations, can get involved and help these individuals and families rebuild their lives here in the United Kingdom. So I hope this gives you an idea of what community sponsorship is and what we as UK Welcomes Refugees are trying to achieve. And if you'd like to learn more, I encourage you to go and check our website to learn more about our vision, our mission, our services, and how you can get involved. Just go to UK Welcomes Refugees, and hopefully any questions you might have will be answered there.
Hi Isabel, hi Abby. I'm Sue Butler from Welcome Churches, and I'd love to tell you a bit about us and how people can get involved. Welcome Churches works nationally, training and equipping churches to welcome and support refugees and those seeking asylum in their immediate location. We now have over 700 churches in our network. These are churches who are actively seeking to reach out to refugees and those seeking asylum who've become their new neighbours living in their area. The churches offer a warm and friendly welcome. Often they help with practical needs, and they're simply being the body of Christ to them. So refugees and asylum seekers can be referred, or they can self-refer, to a welcoming church in their location. So we offer various types of training for churches. We have projects that churches can run to be more proactive in welcoming refugees and asylum seeking neighbours. Our flagship project is Welcome Boxes, where churches visit newly arrived asylum seeking neighbours with a welcome box of small gifts. They say, "Welcome, we are from the church, how can we help you?" And we have a new project that we piloted this summer called Welcome Holidays, where churches can host a short holiday for refugees and asylum seekers connected to another church in another area of the country. We've also been offering Afghan welcomer training for churches involved with the Afghan families that have been evacuated from Afghanistan recently. And we've actually trained over 450 people in the last couple of months, which has been amazing. Behind the headlines, churches are involved in welcoming and offering church community and friendship to refugees and those seeking asylum from all different backgrounds and all kinds of journeys to the UK as well. Some people are on spiritual journeys too, not just physical journeys to the UK, and we do love to equip churches to journey with people in this way towards Christ. If you're thinking or asking how your church can get involved, you can apply to join the Welcome Network. It's free to join, and you'll be visible for refugees and asylum seekers to find you, and you'll be visible for people wanting to find a church to refer someone to in your area. So once you've joined, you can access training and resources via our network website and other training events as well that we offer. Do get in touch with us at info@welcomechurches.org if you want to learn more.
And if you'd like to hear what a difference it makes, I asked a couple of people who come to my church, which is a welcome church for refugees, what they think. So I'm just approaching my church, actually, in Bradford, which is on one of the main roads in and out of the city. And as I walk up to the front of the church, I can see a huge sign which says, "Refugees, welcome here." So we're gonna go inside and we're gonna meet some people who've been welcomed into this church. And there's also a big sign saying, "Free lunch today." So let's go in, get some lunch and meet some people. Behzad, tell me a little bit about this church and why you come here.
If you come to this church, you can feel an amazing atmosphere, and you can see people's help together, and you can see people's are happy here, and I saw parcels food. And another guys come to take it, and I think Jesus' presence here, and everybody is happy here. Everybody likes to help together, and this congratulates me to come and come again to this church.
And what did you think of the fish and chips today?
Oh, it was delicious.
Suleiman, you work for this church. Tell me a bit about your job and why you think this church was a good place to come and spend your time.
Hi. Yes, I'm working here. I have to say, first time when I came to this church, I was asylum. These guys from this church help us, and we don't have a worry about we don't have a family here, because they are our family, God family. We are so happy. When I start work here, we help to anybody, any asylum, any refugee. Yeah, they are happy here because they don't have a worry about they are alone here. They are not alone. They have a family like me when I came here.
And I have to say that our project on a Wednesday where we have a food market, a hot meal, English lessons, etc., about 50% of those volunteers are refugees or asylum seekers themselves, and it's just a really great place to hang out. So these are all great ways. Please do get involved or get in contact. There's loads of protests coming up as well, and if you've got any concerns about the issues we've spoken about today, of course, like Dave, you can write to your MP. You can probably write to any MP, but you might as well write to your MP in the first instance. And the links and advice on how to do that, it's in the show notes. Isabel, it's been great to be with you today. Thanks for joining me on the podcast.
It was a pleasure.
I hope we'll work together again.
I hope so.
If you've enjoyed listening today, why not recommend the show to a friend? And I also want to say a huge thank you to those who've contributed financially since our last episode. Rich knows, who is our director, how much I hate talking about money, but we really appreciate it and we rely on your donations to run the podcast. And we'd love to have more people helping us out. So if you are willing and you have a bit of spare cash, you can donate via the PayPal button at the bottom of our website, which is praxiscentre.org. That's C-E-N-T-R-E. And this new format of episodes obviously has increased costs, and we're running on a bit of a shoestring, so every donation will really help us. And today's thank you goes to Simon Ward, who is a long-term supporter of the podcast in so many ways. So Simon, thank you very, very much. There's loads of other amazing organisations we've mentioned today, so do look how you can support any of those that have drawn you in, and you can find all the links in the show notes attached to this episode on your podcast app or on our website. And we'll be back next month reviewing the work of COP26 and hearing how you can get involved in work for climate justice in response. It's been great to be back with you. Thank you, and goodbye from all of us.
Goodbye.
Bye.